From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Many Americans are starving themselves and exercising like crazy to get the perfect body. On today's edition of Fresh Air, we ask, why are we so obsessed with measuring up to an impossible ideal? I talk with sociologist Barry Glassner, author of Bodies, Why We Look the Way We Do and How We Feel About It. Also, Penelope Spheeris tells us about the making of her new movie, The Decline of Western Civilization, Part 2, The Metal Years. It's a behind-the-scenes look at heavy metal culture. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new album of early recordings by soprano Renata Tobaldi. And language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg examines Hollywood's successes and failures at casting foreigners as Americans and vice versa. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. Barry Glassner says we are being tyrannized by images of the perfect body. Some people think of the current obsession with thinness and fitness as a fad, but Glassner is a sociologist, and he's not ready to dismiss these trends that easily. He wants to know why the lean, exercised look is so popular and what it tells us about society and ourselves. He responds to these questions in his new book, Bodies, Why We Look the Way We Do and How We Feel About It. The book is based in part on a series of interviews Glassner conducted with 90 people around the country. He spoke with men and women about self-image and also interviewed experts such as image consultants, plastic surgeons, and health spa directors. Glassner chairs the sociology department at the University of Connecticut. In his new book, Glassner observes that the landscape has been overrun by images of idealized beauty.
I think that when you just open up a magazine or turn on the television these days, you see it all around you. The images that we're asked to use as mirrors to compare ourselves, our bodies, these are all people who look very, very much different than the way most of us look. You know, they're thinner, they have sort of non-fat, non-smoking, Nautilus-built bodies that just are not very much like what most Americans look like.
Well, you ask a very good question in your book. It seems like an obvious question, but it's one I don't think we ask very much, and that is, why do images of beautiful people hold so much appeal?
Yeah, that was a great mystery for me. That was one of the reasons that I started out to investigate this whole question, go around the country and interview people. And I think the key to that answer is that they stand for so much that's good in this society. I think that we've invested our sort of personal and public morality in these images. They stand for sort of traditional American values, you know, like self-control and prosperity and personal accomplishment and of course, beauty. A person who looks like that, we think, has everything good. They're good people and they're doing well. I think another reason that's quite separate from that is just really purely materialistic, that to make it these days in many corporations and in many kinds of activities in our society, you'd better at least give evidence that you're trying to meet that image, you know, that you're trying to give up smoking or you're trying to lose some weight or that you go down to the health club every day after work. If you look at classified ads for jobs, help wanted ads, it's not uncommon anymore to see these requirements specified per se. Clean, preppy look you see in ads. Right? Your good looks count here. I saw an ad that said that. This is very overt, very above board now. It's no longer just implicit.
But here's a curious thing. You know, if images of beautiful people are being used in part to sell products to us on television, and it holds an appeal to us, at the same time, a lot of people get really kind of jealous and angry when they see this idealized image that they know they'll never be able to reach themselves. So in a way, it's almost like a love-hate relationship I think many people have with this ideal.
Yeah, there was a psychoanalyst who wrote about this, a brilliant psychoanalyst, Otto Fischel, who said that, and I'm grossly paraphrasing here, that we want to be like the person, we want to take on some of their qualities when we see another in this kind of longing way, but at the same time we're angry at the object, at the image. we're angry for precisely the reason you mentioned, that we can't have these qualities, that we try to take them on, but we're doomed to failure. And you see, when we think about the health and fitness movement, when we talk about it normally, it's always entirely in positive terms. And I'm not at all anti-fitness and health. I think it's wonderful that people have become more concerned to get more physical exercise and a healthier diet and so forth. But we never talk about the negative sides. We never talk about the pain that comes along with all of this emphasis on the ideal body. And when I went around the country conducting interviews for this book, Bodies, that's something I kept hearing. I kept hearing about the pain that was associated with this, about people who took up programs and failed. And I kept finding statistics about this. You know, 50% of people who take up exercise programs drop out. Only 2% of dieters maintain their reduced weight. This means lots of failures, lots of, excuse the expression, lower self-esteem. And probably, in the end, it's not even good for personal health when that happens to people. For people for whom it works, it's wonderful.
Well, this leads to a paradox, which you get to in your book, which is that research shows that we're doing more for our bodies, but we're less satisfied with them.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. There was a very interesting poll taken by Psychology Today of its readers. They took it twice, in 1972 and then in 1985. And on every dimension they studied, Americans were less satisfied with their body, with their bodies, you know, with weight, with various regions of their bodies, their face, their chest, their abdomen, and so forth, in 1985 than they were in 72. And of course, 85 was the height of the fitness craze by most measures. We didn't even feel stronger, that poll and others also showed. People were less satisfied with their muscle tone, even though more of them had become more involved. There are a number of studies showing that this has not had the kind of positive effect overall that would be hoped for or that might be anticipated.
Do you have an explanation for that paradox?
Yeah, I think that what's been created is escalating and unrealistic kinds of images, goals for people that they just can't meet. Most of us simply can't achieve what we're supposed to achieve. You know, 30 million women between 25 and 50 wear size 16 or larger, right? The probability that they're going to end up looking like the women in those magazines is slim. And for men, by the way, I like to say that this is the first co-ed book on bodies because you know, there've been a number of books about this kind of concern, but they haven't looked both at men and women. And men, percentages are going up of men, for men who are dissatisfied, especially with their upper body strength and their general shape.
Well, let me ask you about that. I want to reintroduce you first. My guest is Barry Glassner, and he's the author of the new book, Bodies, Why We Look the Way We Do and How We Feel About It. The ideals for men and women have changed. For women, it's thinner and more muscular. For men, more muscular and, more carefully dressed, more hairdos. You say that it kind of gets back to control, that the post-war obsession in America is control, and I'd like for you to explain that.
I think one thing that came out over and over again when I conducted these interviews, when people would talk to me about what they get out of their health and fitness regimen, what came out time and again was this word control. You know, I say in the book, if I had a dollar for every time I heard it, I could buy a health club. The kinds of control they're talking about are control, obviously, over their weight and over their future health and so forth, but not just that. Also control over their emotions, control over their personal well-being, you know, self-satisfaction, that sort of thing. I found a really fascinating study of women's magazines that looked at women's magazines from the 1940s through the 70s. Self-control was the most frequently mentioned topic, more frequently mentioned than love or friendship or beauty or wealth or any of these concerns. And in the last 10 or 15 years, a key way that many middle-class people, at least, have tried to develop that feeling of having self-control, of being in control, is by way of perfecting or trying to perfect their bodies. And, of course, as we said before, so many are failing, And at the same time, there's a lot of guilt that goes along that with that, and blaming people when they fail. So that actually achieving a greater sense of control or self-esteem doesn't come out of these activities for lots of people. For those for whom it does, and I discuss quite a few of them in the book also, it's really wonderful to see. I mean, you do find people who go out and rigorously maintain their exercise schedules and their diets who really benefit very much from it. But that's one part of the story.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that this obsession with control is more of a middle-class obsession?
That seems to be what the national statistics show, right? The percentage of people who smoke is higher among the poor and working class. There are more obese poor and working class people. Fewer get regular exercise programs and so forth. Of course, a lot of that has to do with time and money. I mean, that's this ideal body that so many people are after is a status symbol now, because you have to have the time to work on it. You have to have the money to buy the right diet, the right kind of food, and so forth to achieve it. I found a big difference in philosophies between the people I interviewed who were poor, working class, and upper middle class people. And this sort of echoed a study that was conducted by a fellow named Robert Crawford, a political scientist, about 10 years ago. There's a kind of raise yourself up by your bootstraps, you know, a Horatio Alger notion among the middle class and the upper middle class, that, you know, the road to happiness and good health and long life is paved with diets and exercise programs and with great self-control and so forth. The poor and working class folks have a very different view, that health and well-being is all about having freedom, being able to be strong enough, have enough energy and time enough to go out and do what you want to do, to be able to have a few beers, you know, to be able, you know, sometimes part of the image, especially among younger males, is to be able to drive fast and smoke and survive it, right? A very different kind of notion, and one that these days is thought of as simply wrong-headed, right? That's simply foolishness, okay? And of course, probably they're taking greater risks than middle-class people when they hold to those kinds of views.
I want to get to another paradox in your book, which is filled with paradoxes. And this is that among the people you interviewed, those who were unattractive or disfigured were not the most distressed about their looks. The people who already resembled the media idols, the people who were fairly or very attractive, they were the ones who worked hardest to look better. How do you explain that?
Yeah, you know, I remember, as you say that, an image comes to mind of a man I interviewed who was sort of rotund, flabby fellow. Based on the insurance tables, he'd be very much overweight, was completely satisfied, as near as I could tell, with the way he looked, and he certainly seemed to be. And he said something to me that sort of nailed it down for me, and I'm paraphrasing. He said, if I became skinny, it would just be like putting on another set of clothes. There'd be the same person inside of those clothes. And I found time and again people who had no hope, really, no matter how hard they worked, of approaching the ideal. At some point in their lives, many of them had come to terms with this. They'd found their own strengths, what they liked about themselves, and simply were no longer pursuing this ideal. The people who were most obsessed with it tended to be folks who had some chance, usually remote, of actually achieving it, or were really pretty close, you know, and they then wanted to perfect their bodies, really very much resemble what they saw in the magazines.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk more with you about our obsessions with how we look. My guest, but first we're going to take a short break. My guest is Barry Glassner. We're discussing the subject of his new book, Bodies, Why We Look the Way We Do and How We Feel About It. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
speaking with Barry Glasner, author of the new book, Bodies. Fitness has become a multi-million dollar industry. How much of our obsession with the way we look do you think is fed by recruiting for health clubs, by diet food ads on television, by exercise videotapes, things like that that give us the idea of what the ideal is and what we need to buy to reach it?
Yeah, a lot of the activity is really very much based around the kind of economy that's been set up to support it. You know, it feeds on itself that way, and it becomes very difficult for people to escape that net. Right, there are now at least 50,000 corporations that have corporate fitness and wellness programs, which are in general a good thing, of course, to give people that added benefit in their benefits package. But it also suggests to employees that they bloody well better take care of themselves and attend these sorts of programs if they want promotion, if they want to be integrated into the firm and so forth. And, you know, you really can't well, let me put it a different way. A friend of mine from Europe who was over here said, you know, the last time I was here, shopping malls were popping up everywhere. Now it seems like the countryside here is littered with health clubs. You know, you can't miss them. For people who enjoy it, for people who use their memberships, they're great things. You know, I'm certainly not anti-health club. But the promotion has really tightened the net. I think, though, to answer your question another way, it's what's happened is that so many influential sectors of the culture have gathered together to make personal health the nexus for our public and personal morality, that it becomes the entire discourse about public good, public morality, and so forth. The medical profession, of course, is very much involved with this. I had my annual physical last week, and at the end of the physical, the doctor, who I thought was a wonderful physician, and gave me a great physical, ended by spending 4 or 5 of the precious minutes giving me a little lecture about cholesterol. Now, what was interesting about this is that she had seen that my cholesterol level was within the normal range, right? So why was she giving me this particular talk? Well, because that's the way you end up physicals these days. You tell people they should eat fewer eggs and so forth. What I would love to see is for us to expand this kind of health concern away from these immediate kinds of measures. I mean, it would be wonderful if sometimes she asked me not only for a sample of my blood, you know, but for a sample of the air that was recirculated in the building where I work, you know, or water from my tap to see how much lead was in it. You know.
So you think that our emphasis on making ourselves be fit and look good is distracting our attention away from certain environmental hazards that we have no control over, but, say, our employees, our employers or industry might?
Right. I think that we have decided on some subconscious level over the last 10, 15 years that these external problems, especially environmental problems, are just so overwhelming, so far out of control, that we'd better become invincible, right? Better be able to take care of ourselves and be strong and able to resist them. That's all for the good to a certain extent, except that as we're starting to see with the greenhouse effect and so forth, the environmental problems seem to be getting worse. And what I found in talking to people in interviews for Bodies is that there's great fear about this. Many of the people who are very much obsessed with exactly what they eat and getting just the right amount of exercise and so forth are also very concerned about radon in their homes, about pesticides on their food, and that sort of concern, but aren't doing anything about that, you see. They are doing a lot about what they eat.
What's the kind of thing
that
you feel is out of your control, you know?
Right, but how much is it out of one's control? Mm-hmm. You know, there are plenty of organizations devoted to this kind of activity, and you know, I'm not particularly an environmental activist, environmentalist for that matter. But if one is very much concerned about these kinds of issues, you know, the amount of time that people spend on their personal health in some cases is disproportionate. Why couldn't some of that time be spent on other kinds of collective activities? And you know what's interesting about that is that there's a whole body of studies, of literature, suggesting that people who get involved in their communities, who help others, who become active collectively, tend to live longer and are healthier. Now, that's
are they thinner?
Are they thinner?
And I think that would be the key question.
I suppose it depends on how active you are in that pursuit, right?
I want to ask you about cosmetic surgery. You were talking a little bit before about how you think that some of the obsession with good looks is class-related, that the issue of control seems to be more of a middle-class issue. Cosmetic surgery might possibly be something that would really separate the looks of the affluent from the looks of the poor, because those who can afford it can afford to have, crow's feet removed and chins tucked and noses shortened and those kinds of things. Are you very concerned about this trend of increasing reliance on cosmetic surgery?
I'm finding it to be, interestingly, just an extension of what's been going on in these other areas that we've been talking about. I found a very interesting ad for a cosmetic surgery practice, I think it was in Southern California, where there was a photograph of an attractive woman. The caption said something like, I eat right, I exercise, and I have plastic surgery. and then the notion now is that this is all one package, right? And that if you just do all of these things, you'll be happy and you'll live forever and so forth. And of course, you know, there is some truth to it. I also found a study a good national study actually a few years ago, showing that the more attractive a person is, on average, the higher their income, right? So there are payoffs. And of course, many of those who are going for extensive cosmetic surgery, I don't know about many, I should correct that, certainly a proportion, are having that surgery paid for out of company health programs. And it is to the company's benefit that they improve their looks.
I guess one of the frightening things about cosmetic surgery is that the ideal of how one should look becomes more and more impossible to achieve. I mean, it only becomes surgically possible to achieve it. And I think people who are in a kind of borderline frame of mind of, like, not really caring that much, but on the other hand, not wanting to look bad, feel more and more pressured to consider something like cosmetic surgery because it's their only hope for fitting at all into the ideal.
Right. And you know, more generally than that, we spend a lot of our time worrying that we're doing just the right thing in all of these areas. You know, should I today after work go home and read that new novel that I would so much enjoy reading, or should I go for my workout, you know, or should I spend the money on the vacation or the cosmetic surgery kinds of concerns. You see, my personal concern about this is more that it's one more item in a big package, and that so much money is being spent on this kind of concern that could be going elsewhere. For some people, though, there are also very, very careful studies showing that there are clearly people who benefit from cosmetic surgery. That is, it improves their mental health, at least in the short run. It allows them to get on with, you know, their lives without certain obsessions that have preoccupied them. That's part of, you know, you've been mentioning the paradoxes in the book, and I kept coming across them. And, you know, one of the paradoxes is this, that there's so many pros and so many cons to all of these body concerns.
Well, sure. Listen, I mean, say you're feeling really self-conscious because you have a big nose. And you don't really believe in cosmetic surgery, but you've gotten so self-conscious about it because the ideal has gotten so out of reach that you decide to go for that surgical procedure. I mean, that's a real paradox. It would be giving into something that you don't believe in, but you feel so insecure, you know you'll feel better if you have the surgery.
That's right. That's right. But, you know, what that continues, of course, is a kind of metaphor of doing battle with your body.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think part of the change that is gradually coming about, partly under the influence of New Age kinds of concerns, which I have certain problems with in their own right, but they're moving toward a metaphor of developing peace with one's body, rather than than this continuous battle. And I think that's for the good. You know, I think we go back and forth on this and in the culture about which approach we want.
Now, I think you referred to this earlier, but you say that the most disturbing statistic you've come across in your research is from a Gallup poll that said 93% of Americans agree with this statement: if I take the right actions, I can stay healthy. And what worries you is the converse. That means that if you're not healthy, well, you did something to blow it, and it's probably your own fault.
Yeah. You know what was really disturbing to me when I went around the country doing these interviews is how much we've reverted back to blaming the victim. Blaming a person for their illnesses, blaming the victim. When a person becomes ill with heart disease or cancer, it's not uncommon now for their friends, for their family, for medical personnel to at least implicitly blame them. You know, if they'd gotten more exercise, if they'd just eaten fewer eggs in the morning, you know, whatever, this wouldn't have happened. But we know, of course, that it's a very complex matter. There are many variables in the equation, including genetic, a variety of social psychological variables, and so forth. And yet it's simpler now in, again, our public discourse to just narrow it, center everything around these individual kinds of changes that people can make. But we're leaving aside, you know, we talk about all the progress that's been made, right? Progress towards a healthier nation. People who push the fitness revolution like to point to statistics of lower decreases in heart disease mortality and so forth. And that's all wonderful. I think it's great that we've achieved that. But during the same period, roughly the late 60s to present, there have been a variety of areas in which our public health has gotten worse. Right? There were 5 billion injuries on the job in 1986. That's up 13% from 1983. Right? The hunger statistics, which have a lot to do with health concerns, are much worse now than they were in the late 60s. We spend more of our GNP, of our gross national product, on health care than any other nation, but our infant mortality rate is 17th worst of 20 industrialized nations. I guess I'm saying that I think we've been premature in congratulating ourselves. Right? We can congratulate ourselves on having taken the individual actions, but not on having taken the social collective kinds of actions, leaving 37 million people uninsured. Right? And that number is up 25% just since 1980. I'm not blaming this, by the way. I want to hasten to add, because I've been accused of this, not blaming fitness advocates for having brought these kinds of statistics about. But I am suggesting that we can't keep distracting ourselves this way, and we can't keep thinking that we're going to solve the problems this way.
Barry Glasner, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you. Barry Glasner is the author of Bodies, Why We Look the Way We Do and How We Feel About It. It's published by Putnam. He's the chair of the sociology department at the University of Connecticut. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional funding comes from World of Travel Guidebooks, featuring the removable travel planner, designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Fresh Air receives additional support from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming Coming up, Penelope Spheris talks about being front row center at a Megadeth concert, backstage with Alice Cooper, and in the kitchen with Ozzy Osbourne, all in the course of making her documentary about heavy metal rock. The film is a companion to Spheris's punk rock documentary, The Decline of Western Civilization. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has an appreciation of soprano Renata Tobaldi and a review of an album featuring her early performances. And language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg talks about linguistic authenticity in the movies, or why Englishman Bob Hoskins' effort to sound like an American gumshoe in the hit film Who Framed Roger Rabbit doesn't quite make it. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Sharon Green. UN Secretary General Perez de Cuellar met twice today with Iraq's foreign minister in continuing talks aimed at ending the Iran-Iraq war. But the Iraqi minister told reporters that peace prospects remain dim unless direct talks take place between the two sides. NPR's Margot Adler reports.
Tariq Aziz, Iraq's foreign minister, called his meeting with the secretary general a courtesy call and then insisted that Iran, by reluctantly accepting UN Resolution 598 and referring to it as poison, was not really seeking peace.
If the Iranians do not accept that formula, that means that they are not sincere about peace, and we shall still remember what their leader said.
The Iraqi minister warned that his country would not be stampeded into a ceasefire until face-to-face talks took place. Despite these harsh words, Secretary General Perez de Cuellar still said he was optimistic that a date for a ceasefire could be arranged sometime next week. The Secretary General meets with Iran's Foreign Minister Ali Akbar Velayati this evening. I'm Margot Adler in New York.
The Commerce Department reports that the economy continued to grow robustly in the second quarter of the year. The gross national product, measuring the total output of U.S. goods and services, grew at a 3.1% annual rate from April through June. That's down from earlier this year, but economists say the decline reflects a drop in farm output caused by the drought. Analysts say there is a downside. Inflation appears to be growing as the economy continues to expand. In an interview published in Cairo today, Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak said he thinks the United States is willing to meet with members of the Palestine Liberation Organization, and he said Egypt would be willing to arrange a meeting between mid-level PLO members and U.S. envoy Richard Murphy, who reportedly is scheduled to visit the Middle East next month. The United States has consistently refused to deal with the PLO until it recognizes Israel's right to exist. The U.S. Air Force has confirmed a West German television report that American pilots are allowed to take stimulants on long flights and sedatives to help them sleep later. However, the Air Force says use of the drugs is barred for normal day-to-day training flights. Deidre Berger has the story.
The U.S. Air Force regularly gives pilots dexedrine and secanol to help their flight performance. That charge came in the TV program Monitor, the West German version of 60 Minutes. The accusation was made by an unidentified U.S. military officer in West Germany who was shown in shadow on the program. The officer said dexedrine is used to help the pilots stay alert, and secanol is used to help them sleep when they land to prepare them sooner for the next flight. Dexedrine is banned in West Germany, although it can be legally prescribed in the U.S. U.S. Air Force headquarters in Ramstein, West Germany, said the two drugs are given to pilots involved in long overseas solo flights. But the Air Force denied the drug is routinely given to pilots making 1 or 2 hour training flights in Europe. For National Public Radio, this is Deidre Berger in Cologne.
NASA engineers at Cape Canaveral are trying to make up for an 8 hour delay in preparations for a critical test firing of the Space Shuttle Discovery's rockets. The test is scheduled for Sunday. With the countdown underway, the National Research Council today released a report criticizing NASA for being poorly prepared to predict weather conditions when space shots are launched. The report warned that unless improvements are made, weather could pose a major hazard to the accelerated schedule of flights now planned for the space program. Stock prices were lower on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average closed down 20 points at 2053.70. Declines led advances 2-1 on volume of 136 million shares. Analysts said prices were depressed by a weakening of the dollar and a higher-than-expected rise in inflation as measured by the gross national product. You're listening to National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. The Italian soprano Renata Tobaldi was one of the world's most beloved singers during her career, from the late 40s to the early 70s. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has a review of a new album of Tubaldi's early recordings and live performances, and he's found a number of reasons, some of them surprising, for her overwhelming success.
Could any singer ever have been regarded with more affection than Renata Tubaldi? Not just admired for her voice or valued for her artistry, but loved. It was a personal thing. She had one of the most luscious lyric soprano voices in the history of opera. Satin without the coldness, velvet without the fuzz. It could fill La Scala and the Metropolitan Opera House, yet it seemed vulnerable and precious too. She was especially convincing in passive roles, innocent victims. Listen to her unquestioning sincerity and directness as Verdi's Desdemona, or in Italian, Desdemona, in the Willow Song from Otello. There's a profound kind of simplicity in this singing that reflects the purity of the character. Tubaldi wasn't an interpreter with great dramatic or musical insights, but her unaffected manner, embodied in a voice of such breathtaking beauty, made her extraordinarily poignant, lovable. But the live performances on this remarkable new disc also give us some other, perhaps less attractive reasons for her power. She was, we can hear, not above stooping to some pretty stagey, even vulgar effects, the traditional heaving sob of the provincial opera singer, the brassy chest voice, the forced high note. These very crudities were actually elements of her popularity. She was not a creature apart, cut off from the audience, completely wrapped up in the torments of her character. She was willing to play to the audience. No wonder, then, that for all her unassertiveness, the newspapers and the public could revel in a manufactured feud between Tubaldi and her arch-rival, Maria Callas, whose persistent demands for artistic perfection made so much trouble for everyone. Even in these recordings from the earlier half of Tubaldi's career, you can detect the problems that would plague her later, near misses in pitch that turned into wider and wider gaps, a creeping steeliness and shrillness, and occasional lapses of musical judgment. But the honesty and generosity of that gorgeous, youthful voice is sheer pleasure here. The repertory is mostly familiar, the great Verdi and Puccini roles, Violetta, Desdemona, Butterfly, Mimi, Manon Lescaut, and other Italian opera heroines, Maddalena in Andrea Chenier, lamenting the death of her mother in the French Revolution and celebrating her own salvation through love, the actress Adriana Lecouvreur singing about being a handmaiden to her art. One unusual choice for Tibaldi is Depuis le Jour from Charpentier's Louise, which she sings ardently, not in French, but in creamy Italian. And she's surprisingly impressive, really heroic, in the Inflammatas from Rossini's Stabat Mater. Find revelations, but after hearing Tibaldi's heartfelt rendition of the slandered Desdemona's Ave Maria, you might find it hard to resist the impulse to rush to her defense.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed Renata Tibaldi, A Portrait of the Artist, 1949 to 1958. It's on the Legato Classics label. This is Fresh Air. Heavy metal is loud, aggressive music. Its biggest audience is teenage boys, and it drives a lot of their parents crazy.
Who's that?
When parents groups condemn rock music for devil worship and brutal sexual imagery, it's usually heavy metal they're talking about. Penelope Spheris is a 42-year-old filmmaker who thinks the heavy metal scene is a lot more interesting than her contemporaries acknowledge. It's the subject of her new documentary, The Decline of Western Civilization, Part 2, The Metal Years. It's a companion to her first film, a documentary on punk rock called The Decline of Western Civilization. Penelope Spheris' new film covers the metal scene through interviews and concert footage.
Attention, everybody!
Attention!
Attention, you creatures from another planet.
Hello, suckers.
Please be advised.
Be advised that
by your entry upon these premises,
you are consenting to being photographed and filmed, naked or otherwise,
and having your ugly likeness
and sound effects used in motion pictures and
home porno and other purposes.
You sick, dirty dogs, you.
Thank you.
Thank you, and give us your money.
I've been going to the club scene in Los Angeles for quite a few years, ever since I made the first Decline of Western Civilization in the late 70s, and I just recently, in the last year or so, noticed a very strong resurgence of energy in the music scene, and it was centered around that which we, for lack of a better term, call heavy metal.
Now, in your movie, you've gotten some really pretty articulate, candid responses from some of the metal musicians. Were you worried when you started this movie that no one would really speak honestly or speak well to you? Well, I mean, let's face it, the metal musicians don't have a reputation for being the most articulate articulate musicians.
I think that's really an unfair assumption on the part of most people. Mostly, I think it's the critics that think that way, and a lot of, you know, a lot of those kind of Springsteen U2 fans like to look at the metal musicians and think that they're stupid and that they're not very sophisticated and that they're not good musicians. And I think that those three assumptions are really unfair, because as you can see from my film, I think you notice that there are just, you know, it's such a broad spectrum of society, the people that are involved in this music. You're going to get a broad spectrum of intelligence and also of taste, you know, and musicianship. So many of them I found they're great, you know, they're great people, and I hope that it comes across in that film.
You've shot some of these musicians in pretty unusual settings. For instance, Paul Stanley of Kiss, you have him in a bed surrounded by four or five teenage girls. Each one seems to have appropriated a different one of his limbs. whose idea was it to shoot him that way?
When the various, star artists that we shot agreed to do the film, I told them that I would let them help decide how they were going to be shot. Because, of course, they're nervous about, you know, how they look to the public. Gene Simmons from Kiss wanted to be interviewed in a lingerie store, so we did that with girls walking around changing their clothes in the background. It was pretty funny. And as you say, Paul Stanley was in bed with four girls. But that was Paul's idea to do that, and I felt a little strange about it because, if you haven't noticed, I'm a woman, and I thought, well, you know, it seems a little strange to be shooting women in this compromising position. But I will do it because it really is a statement about rock and roll, and it's also a statement about Kiss. You know, for years, their music has been very sex-oriented. It's not love-oriented, mind you, or relationship-oriented. It's sex-oriented, and those guys are real proud of that, and that's how he wanted to be seen, so we shot it that way. It gets a lot of reaction in the theater.
Now, you shot the guitarist from Wasp, Chris Holmes, in his swimming pool. He's floating around on a raft and basically pouring
Vodka.
I wasn't sure what it was. Pouring vodka down his throat. I mean, just gulping it down.
Literally pouring it down his throat.
And his mother's watching from the side of the pool.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder whose idea it was to shoot him in that setting with his mother watching.
When I started talking to Chris about doing this interview, he said that he wanted to do the interview drunk. And I said, "Are you sure?" And he said, "Yes, I am." And so we did that. And I suggested that we shoot it in a pool just because, you know, having directed films for as long as I have, I know that it's better when the geography is interesting, you know. So I said, "Yeah, let's do it in a pool." He goes, "Great, and I'll wear my leather." So I said, you're gonna mess up your leathers? And he said, "Ah, don't worry, it's been wet from sweat on the stage thousands of times." So he puts his leather outfit on, lays in the pool in a chair, and he asked that his mother be there, because he's really good friends with his mother, Sandra Holmes. And I had met her before, too. I said, "Okay, that's a fabulous idea, because I personally am into, you know, understanding people via their backgrounds and families. So I thought, this is great. Let's sit down and tell the truth here." And I think it got pretty heavy. It's the part of the film that most people refer to as, you know, the strongest moment.
What do you think you're going to be doing 10 years from now?
I'll probably be dead. You can come see my graveyard. Mom, have a drink.
Chris, do you drink very much?
Pardon?
Do you drink very much?
Yes, I do. I'm a full-blown alcoholic.
Just when he's awake.
Do you think a rock and roll lifestyle turned you into an alcoholic?
Yes, it does.
How much of that do you drink a day?
About 5 pints. Yeah, I'm a happy camper.
Well, you know, it's interesting. Some of the older metal musicians talk about how they ended up having to give up drugs, how it just got to be a drag, or they got too sick from it. Ozzy Osbourne, for instance, in his kitchen where you shot him, talks about going to the Betty Ford Clinic.
Yes. I think it's inevitable when you get to a certain age that you can't really operate and function using drugs. And I think they would, you know, they all agreed that they probably would be in better shape today if they never had used the drugs. And for me personally, that was a great realization to be able to put on film to show the kids out there. Because for years, unfortunately, you know, kids have had role models of rock stars who have been, you know, arrested for drugs, in and out of clinics trying to clean up, wasted on stage, passing out. And, you know, to say to a kid that this is part of the lifestyle and it works would just be awful. So I was able to take the information they gave me and turn it into the point that it just doesn't work. Using drugs and alcohol doesn't work.
I get tired of waking up hungover and having to do a couple of lines and a couple of beers just to get moving, you know, which is where it was at. And then you got to get that together so you can go and cop dope.
But after a while, when you do it so much, it's not the same as the first time. You know, it turns into, it turns against you, especially with drugs.
Go check out Jim Morrison and Jimi Hendrix and Janis Joplin. That's not my idea of fun.
Because it's a lot of hours of throwing up blood and stuff like that. And if you're going to do that on stage, it's great, but it's not that much fun in a Holiday Inn, you know?
Your first documentary film was The Decline of Western Civilization, Part One, and that was on punk rock and hardcore music in Los Angeles. Your new movie is on heavy metal music. Do you see any connections between those two different scenes?
Well, they're both hard music, you know. It's not Barry Manilow here, folks, you know. So there is that. The difference, I think, is that punk had a bit more social and political consciousness than does the metal music. Metal music is party music. It's like just, you know, forget about your problems and have a good time kind of music. And I think that's okay. The other differences are that the kids in the punk scene were very sort of hesitant about the whole idea of rock stardom. And they realized the stupidity of chasing a dream like that. However, the kids in the new film center their whole lives around trying to be rock stars.
Don't matter up or down, sideways in or out, if it makes you feel good, do it, and then get out. You'll be living on a razor's edge. Listen to what I say. Don't spend your life in your own bed, cradle to the grave.
That's the group Motorhead from the soundtrack of Penelope Spheeris' new film, The Decline of Western Civilization, Part Two, The Metal Years. Tomorrow, Penelope Spheeris talks about her own life, growing up in a carnival family. This is Fresh Air. Let's get a preview of what's coming up on All Things Considered and check in with Robert Siegel, who co-hosts the program. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
What stories are you following?
Well, we're following the talks at the UN on the Iran-Iraq war today. Iraq's representative met with the UN authorities talking about a ceasefire. We'll also have a report on the Chelsea school system of Chelsea, Massachusetts, being put under the jurisdiction of Boston University. It's a new twist. And a survey taken in 9 countries, one of them the U.S., of geography, knowledge of basic geography. Americans did not do very well.
Why aren't I surprised?
I don't know. It's one of many, many studies of this kind. Also, the covert plan to oust Noriega. This obviously amplifies the overt plan to oust Noriega.
Thanks, Robert. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. All English-speaking people do not sound alike. Language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg says you can hear this for yourself in some recent American movies.
There's a story they tell about Edith Head, the famous Hollywood costume designer. Somebody asked her what she thought about Gone with the Wind, and she said, "Well, I don't see what the fuss was all about. The hems are an inch thick." I felt sort of the same way when I saw Who Framed Roger Rabbit. I'll grant you that it's an enormously entertaining film. But I have to confess that I kept being distracted by the Englishman Bob Hoskins' struggle with an American accent.
Nothing's changed. Somebody's made a patsy out of me, and I'm going to find out why.
Now, it may be that this is a nit that only a linguist would think of picking. But you have to admit that there's something weird about having Hoskins play the part as an American in the first place. After all, Who Framed Roger Rabbit is a movie that asks us to believe that cartoon characters are walking around in the middle of flesh and blood Hollywood. If the audience is willing to swallow that, why would anybody care if the hero happened to have an English accent? In the old Hollywood, nobody bothered about getting accents right. When the Australian Errol Flynn played an American in westerns like Santa Fe Trail and Virginia City, he just talked like Errol Flynn and nobody raised an eyebrow. But modern movies require linguistic authenticity, whatever other liberties they may take with reality. As a result, we've had to listen to a succession of Englishmen and Australians trying their hand at American, and vice versa. Some actors can bring it off. Barbara Hershey does a credible South African accent in the recently released A World Apart, for example. And the South African-born Lawrence Harvey sounded plausibly American in The Manchurian Candidate and in the 1960 movie The Alamo, where he played Colonel Travis opposite John Wayne's Davy Crockett.
Crockett, you're not the illiterate country bumpkin you would have people believe. You speak an excellent and concise English when you wish. The bad grammar is a pose.
Well, a fella has to do a lot of things to get elected to Congress. I've kissed many a baby, too.
And then, of course, there was Peter Sellers, whose ear for accents was positively Mozartian. Sellers didn't just do an American accent, he did all of them. He did Americans differently in Dr. Strangelove, in Being There, and particularly in his extraordinary performance as Claire Quilty in Lolita.
Didn't you have a daughter with a lovely name? Yeah, a lovely, what was it now? A lovely lyrical, lilting name like,
Lolita.
Lolita, that's right. Lolita, diminutive of Dolores, the tears and the roses. Yeah.
Wednesday she's going to have a cavity filled by your Uncle Ivor.
Yes. Yes.
But there are few actors who have Sellers' gift, and for them, I'd advise a little linguistic discretion. In last year's Lethal Force, Mel Gibson played an American cop with an accent that he could only have picked up by sitting through Rocky 50 times.
Come on. I'm just gonna stand here and talk to you. That's all.
You won't try nothing?
No, I'm square with you. I won't try a thing. I won't try a damn thing. You think I want to fall off? I promise, I'll just talk to you.
Now, I can see why Gibson would want to try for an authentic American voice in a naturalistic movie like The River. But Lethal Force was one of those cop buddy movies with a storyline that read as if it had been lifted from a video game. Surely somebody could have come up with a plot gimmick that would have let Gibson play the role in his own quite charming Australian accent. After all, it was good enough for Errol Flynn.
Welcome to West Point, sir. May I direct you to the Commandant?
Yes, if he's the proper person for me to see. I'm Mr. Custer, George Armstrong Custer of Monroe, Michigan. I've been appointed to the Academy as a cadet.
The Tasmanian-born Errol Flynn and They Died With Their Boots On. Jeffrey Nunberg is a linguist associated with the Institute for Research on Learning in Palo Alto, California. Here's a look at tomorrow's fresh air. Tomorrow, part two of my interview with film director Penelope Spheeris. In films like The Decline of Western Civilization and Suburbia, she sees herself as a sociologist exploring youth culture. Spheeris says that the youth culture is something Hollywood doesn't really understand, and film executives have told her they use her films to catch up. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Dreams of Life, the new Patti Smith record, and film critic Stephen Schiff reviews two new comedies, A Fish Called Wanda and Midnight Run. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Salad, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Production assistants from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Ron Barron. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.